Next case, U.S. v. Harris, 13-1741. Ms. Christensen?
May it please the Court, Counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent the appellant, Susan Harris, in this matter. Ms. Harris was denied a fair trial in this case by the impanelment of an anonymous jury. All the district court said was, to protect people's privacy, we try to refer to jurors by numbers now. We do this just to protect your privacy, which is very important, is a very important consideration in the modern world. The judge wasn't referring to privacy in like someone peeping in a window. It was not referring to the modern world as talkies and horseless carriages. It's obvious from what the court meant is that in this modern world, we need to be concerned about people taking our identifying information, our social security numbers, our birth dates, and using it to commit fraud. Exactly what Ms. Harris was charged with in this case. The only logical conclusion a juror could come to after hearing this at the very beginning, before they're even questioned on voir dire, is the defendant is someone who is dangerous and we need to be protected from. As this court is more than aware, most of these cases involving anonymous juries are large street gang cases or RICO conspiracies. Often the Chicago outfit is involved, or things like the Latin Kings or the Insane Deuces gangs, where there's a history of both juror intimidation, court interference, violence, and those punishments are very severe. There's also a lot of publicity involved in those cases. And this court is aware in this courthouse, when there is a large case going on, the courtroom is full of reporters every day. It's not the case in Ms. Harris's case. There was a press release when she was convicted and a press release when she was sentenced, and that's the extent to which the publicity was involved. Furthermore, the court didn't weigh any of these factors.
Well, obviously no objections were made. Ms. Christensen, does the record indicate at any point that the parties and counsel did not know the identities of the jurors?
No. Well, that's a difficult question. The record as it originally existed, when I first was appointed.
As it originally existed.
Right. There was no indication what the parties knew about the jurors. The only indication on the record is that short sentence that I read that the district court stated, we're referring to you by numbers.
Well, let's suppose we're dealing with full-blown, truly anonymous jury. The parties don't know either. Has that ever been treated as a plain error?
I'm unaware of any cases where it's been found to be plain error that's reversible plain error. I believe the Mansouri case, I could be wrong about it. It could be Morales. I don't believe it was raised below, but I don't think they found plain error because the judge had made findings about the dangerousness, potential dangerousness to the jurors, and the defendant's history of violence and interfering with the judicial process. This case, it is plain error, and obviously we would have a better record.
It's a plain error standard.
It's a plain error standard.
Why should this be treated as plain error? Since this seems to me to be the paradigm case for saying we need an objection, a timely objection, so that the issue can be addressed in the district court.
It is. Obviously, it would always be better to have an objection. But the fact that there was not objection does not change the prejudice that was caused to Ms. Harris in having in this jury thinking that they needed to be protected from her.
Well, it might, for example, have prompted the record to be supplemented in the way that it has been attempted to be supplemented on appeal.
Mm. True, Your Honor. And that's why we argue both ways in our brief, in that we're not arguing the affidavits that the government has submitted are untrue in any way. That's certainly what happened. I wasn't there, but it makes logical sense that would have happened behind the scenes at the trial. However, that cures the parties not knowing, or whether the parties knew about the names and addresses and that sort of information. It does not cure the district court's statement that prejudiced the jurors against Ms. Harris. And that error is plain. And I think that, and this is, you know, maybe conjecture from what the court said, it sounds as if this is a standard in jury trials in this district. This is what they do.
Was it?
Was it a standard?
Was it routine, either in the Southern District of Illinois or before Judge Murphy?
That I do not know. I don't practice in the Southern District regularly, so I wouldn't know. And we don't. There aren't very many trials in general, criminal trials that come to us. But it's not in their jury plan in any way. And I cited to the jury plan because I looked to see perhaps this is, you know, something they've done to protect across the board. But it's not in the jury plan.
So at this point, in terms of your argument, it really boils down to the fact that that statement was made, because you've admitted that now that the affidavits were admitted and reviewed, that the parties didn't have all the appropriate information with the jurors.
Right. I don't find any fault factually with the government's assertions. I find fault with the manner in which they were added to the record.
The problem with that is, of course, there was no objection, and so had there been an objection at the time, all of that material would have come in. So we essentially would be rewarding a lack of objection.
Well, that's true, except we're also rewarding the government changing the record midstream on appeal.
There is an irony in this argument, I hope you appreciate.
I do, Your Honor.
Okay.
I do appreciate the irony of the argument, and we always would rather have an objection be made, but I'm presented, when I have a case on appeal, with a record as it exists when I get the case. And I brief issues that are based on that record. I can't assume things that aren't in the record. And certainly when the issue was originally briefed, I thought perhaps it's a possibility that they knew, and it just was never brought up because there was no objection. But that's not in the record. I can't make an argument based on what my assumption, knowledge of practice is. I have to do what's on the record. And then when the government changes that after my brief is filed, that to me is a dangerous precedent. You know, this case is about Ms. Harris, of course, primarily, and the jury trial, but it is also about the precedent that this would set.
Ms. Christensen, what were the issues at trial? I'm trying to assess the gravity of the error, if any.
Right.
What were the issues at trial that the jury really had to decide?
And that goes to the harmless error. The issues at trial were that this woman, Ashley Drummond, who was the primary witness against Ms. Harris, was Ms. Harris's friend. And she said that they had agreed together to steal clients' information from the hospital and enter it online to get credit cards and spend those credit cards. All of the information that Ms. Harris was directly involved came from Ms. Drummond. Her email address was entered on some of the forms. Her home address, her telephone number, Ms. Harris's were entered. But those were all things that Ms. Drummond knew from being her friend. They were friends prior to the offense. And there was the direct evidence that Ms. Harris was involved in that she was the person sitting there inputting the information was very slight. The prejudice, if this were an overwhelming case of you know, that one sentence by the district court may not have made a difference. But this is not an overwhelming case. This is one woman saying about another woman that we did this together. Ms. Harris, that was her issue at trial, that she was not part of this conspiracy or part of the conspiracy to commit the mail fraud.
But there were images on some of these credit card applications where the victim's Social Security number was there, but it was Harris's email and address, and cards were activated by Harris's telephone number, so there was some independent evidence aside from Drummond.
Right. And what was argued at trial is that Drummond could have entered that information and was over at Harris's enough that she could have also used the phone number. You know, it was based on Drummond's testimony and her credibility solely. There was some documentary evidence, but it all could have been linked to Drummond as well as linked to Ms. Harris, seen it two different ways. So I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
All right.
I'll reserve the rest of my
All
time.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Holm?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Neil Hong on behalf of the United States, and we're requesting that the court affirm the defendant's conviction. Now, this court didn't panel an anonymous jury in this case, and she wasn't prejudiced. I believe counsel said that the judge gave the reasoning that in a modern world, we need to protect privacy. And I think she stretches that statement saying, well, what the district court's really kind of hinting is that, well, in this modern world, you know, we have a lot of credit cards and she's on trial for identity theft, so we need to protect you from her. But, you know, that statement could also be taken, well, you know, there's a lot of media out there and perhaps they don't want their names to be out there. That statement is not specific to the defendant. The judge never specifically said, well, in this case, you know, we're going to do this. This is a routine practice. And in fact, in the Southern District, this is a routine practice that the jurors are not identified by name and just by number. So there'd be no prejudice in that.
And is the routine practice then to share to counsel, that counsel get all the specific information?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's part of the practice.
Yes, part of the practice is there are books that are arranged with all the juror questionnaires that are filled out, and they're given to the parties and to the judge, and it's just that the jurors themselves are not identified by name, even though the names are provided, as well as other biographical information. And in this case, there was no anonymous jury, in this sense. I have nothing further to say, unless Your Honor has any questions. I'll yield the rest of my time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Hong. Ms. Christensen? A minute.
30
I'll be generous. 30 more seconds.
Well, I really just have three comments. I don't know what else the modern world could mean. I think that we all know.
Well, the modern world could mean tweeting, texting. You know.
It could mean any number of things. But when you, if I say, oh, in this modern world, I should be concerned. Right here, we're not talking necessarily about a fraud trial. But to a bunch of jurors sitting in a courtroom who are being told that they're going to hear evidence on a mail fraud identity theft case, that narrows the focus. It has to. And now that we know that it is the routine practice in the Southern District of Illinois, I think that raises constitutional questions not only for Ms. Harris, but for all of the defendants. And perhaps it's not being objected to. Perhaps I'm the only defense attorney who has an issue with it. But if they're not individualized determinations for each defendant, I think that's a problem. There's a right to a public jury trial, and the public has a certain right to know what goes on in courthouses. And referring
But you're not suggesting that the jurors' names have to be disclosed.
I don't think they have to be disclosed, but I think there has to be some sort of balancing done in every case if it's a necessity to keep the jurors in this kind of seclusion rather than a physical seclusion, sort of a electronic seclusion, so their names can't be used anywhere, suggests that people shouldn't want to serve on juries because in some way it will hurt them, either exposure in the media or exposure to dangerousness. And I think that's a difficult road to travel for any court who are struggling to get jurors to serve.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Christensen.
Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for your briefs and your argument. We'll take the case under advisement.